Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, what goes up comes down hard, what Russia owes, and what happiness can cost. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, today, the 15th of March. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Hey, so you know that thing I say sometimes about stocks going down too on a day or days of precipitous drops? Turns out the same thing happens with oil. Crude a week ago above $130 a barrel. Today, straight off the cliff, $98 and change. And hey, look, gas is down too, from a national average of $4.33 a gallon to $4.32. Marketplace's Lily Jamali has got the What Gives assignment today.
Ask any driver about gas prices right now, and you'll probably hear a version of this.
Way too expensive, not worth it. I hope they go down soon.
That's college student Sam Appleyard filling up at a Shell station in Houghton, Michigan. She just skipped spring break with family because gas prices were so high.
I've been actually like trying to wait it out because I've been hoping that they would eventually go down, but they haven't yet.
That might change, and soon, as oil prices keep falling, says Tom Kloza, global head of energy analysis at Opus.
We're seeing prices just cascade lower. I mean, it's happening at a breathtaking speed.
Kloza says the price drop and its pace are due in part to recent COVID restrictions in China.
They are the fastest growing consumer of refined products and crude in the world.
After Russia's invasion of Ukraine last month, uncertainty ruled the oil markets. That's according to Clark Williams Derry of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
When you don't know whether you can buy oil next week or next month, or in 3 months, you try to lock in your supplies now to reduce your risk.
He says traders now have more clarity about the West's approach towards Russia, and that's helped drive oil prices lower. Seeing that reflected as cheaper gas, though, will take time, says Kelly Sanders of the University of Southern California.
The gasoline that we pump today actually reflects the price of crude that refineries purchased weeks ago.
Sanders is also hoping relief comes soon.
I can tell you, here in Los Angeles, we're not seeing it yet.
But she says gas prices follow oil a lot more quickly on the way up than on the way down. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
You think regular gas prices are bad? Don't look at diesel. I did it for you. $5.12 a gallon this weekend, not adjusted for inflation, to be clear. But here's the thing, that diesel price could leave your pocketbooks running on empty even if you don't drive a truck, as Marketplace's Matt Levin reports.
If you're listening to this in a minivan or a Prius, you probably don't notice the price of diesel when you drive by the corner gas station. But oil analyst Troy Vincent with the commodities firm DTN says you should.
People often underestimate, you know, these kind of second order effects of higher diesel prices and how they hit your pocketbook.
Many container ships run on diesel. Freight trains run on diesel. So do big rigs and agricultural machinery and some delivery vans. And while demand for regular gas subsided during the pandemic because fewer people were driving, all those Amazon Prime orders meant demand for diesel grew.
The vast majority of that freight process behind those deliveries to your home is ultimately powered with diesel fuel.
It's why global diesel inventories were low before the Ukraine crisis. Alan Schaefer with the Diesel Technology Forum says Europe is now especially vulnerable because it depends on Russia for refined diesel, as well as natural gas and crude.
A lot of their diesel fuel comes out of Russia.
And while some commuters can take public transit to avoid paying higher gas prices, it's not easy to substitute away from diesel. Container ships can't take the subway.
we don't see any necessarily widespread replacements of diesel fuel over time.
The shipping industry is trying to find savings where it can, adding more biodiesel from soybeans, which currently accounts for a little less than a tenth of diesel consumption. Luisa Fernandez-Willey with the Association of American Railroads says freight operators are exploring fuel-saving technology.
They're using different types of fuel and then also looking at, you know, an electric locomotive.
But for now, most freight runs on diesel, just like much of the rest of the economy. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, stocks up, bonds down. The word you're looking for here is risk on, baby. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Federal Reserve meets today and tomorrow. As you know, a modest bump in interest rates is in the offing, but that is not the Fed news of today. President Biden's nominee to be the vice chair of the Board of Governors for supervision, Sarah Bloom Raskin is her name. She withdrew this morning in the face of Republican and Senate Democrat Joe Manchin's opposition to her views on climate change. Raskin has not been shy in saying that she believes the Fed, as with other parts of the government, must consider a warming planet when making policy. In her withdrawal letter to the president today, Raskin said, in part, Chairman Powell has recognized climate change as a significant risk that needs to be incorporated into the supervisory process. That identification and prioritization, she went on, is not only within the mandate of the Federal Reserve, it is essential to the well-being of the country. It should be said here that Raskin was confirmed 12 years ago by the Senate to be a member of the Fed's Board of Governors and in 2014 to be Deputy Secretary of the Treasury. At the risk of getting just a touch too weedy on you here, Russia's got a bond payment due tomorrow, $117 million in dollar bond payments. That means they borrowed in dollars, thus have to pay back in dollars, which is going to be tricky given that Moscow can't actually get to its dollar-denominated bank accounts right now. And rubles? Who's going to take rubles? Am I right? So, allowing for the standard 30-day grace period, Russia's about this close to default. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour is on the And Then What Happens desk today.
So, just like the U.S., the Russian government sells bonds for the same reason any country sells bonds.
If you'd like to expand a social program or you'd like to, you know, increase defense spending and you don't have the money sitting on hand, which most places do not, then you would go market and you'd issue, in our country, treasuries.
For Russia, they're called OFZs, and that was KPMG senior economist Tim Mahidi. Now, here's the thing. Russia doesn't issue a ton of these things.
If you're just looking across the world, you wouldn't look at Russia and think, oh, man, that's something that I should really be concerned with.
The amount Russia owes to its bondholders comes to about 15% of its GDP, according to the Institute of International Finance. By comparison, the U.S. owes 100% of GDP worth of debt. So Russia would be in good shape financially to pay its debts, except for two problems.
One, the magnitude of the sanctions.
Roberto Sifon is chief analytical officer for sovereign debt at S&P Global. Sanctions this massive, freezing Russia's central bank assets, make it mighty hard to make payments. That is one problem. Problem number two, Sifon says it's not even clear Russia wants to pay on its debt.
One of the first measures they took was to forbid the transfers of debt repayment to foreign investors.
Russia did say it could pay its debt in rubles, but rubles would be useless to foreign investors. They're worth pennies on the dollar, and you can't really convert them to dollars anyway these days. S&P, Moody's, and Fitch all downgraded Russian debt. Fitch basically said default was imminent. So what if that happens? What if Russia defaults?
The consequences for Russia, immediate consequences, are not very significant.
Alina Rybakova is deputy chief economist at the Institute of International Finance.
However, the long-term implications are severe.
Basically, who is going to trust Russia to pay its debts in the future if it defaults now?
Once you have defaulted on your debt, it takes a long time for foreign investors to come back because they're wary. They remember that episode.
The door to raising money from the rest of the world will be shut for a very long time. And it is a very big door. It took Argentina 15 years to regain access to the world's investors after it defaulted in 2001. And Russia may have to pay very high interest rates just to try to get financing. And that can drive up interest rates in the rest of the country, which limits Russian economic growth. As for the effects of default on the rest of the world,
in terms of impact on the global markets, I don't think it will be significant impact.
Rybakova says Russia has been isolating itself from the rest of the world financially for years. So the rest of the world is also insulated from Russia. Most of Russia's debt, 80%, according to S&P Global, is owed to investors inside Russia. About $60 billion is owed to investors everywhere else. Some bondholders would get stung, including big-name investment firms, but the overall exposure is pretty low. Again, KPMG's Tim Mahidi.
The amount of Russian assets held by U.S. banks of cross-border exposures is less than Poland, half of Sweden, one-fifth of Italy, and one-fiftieth of the U.K.
But there is a catch, and it is cruel. Some struggling, developing countries could easily pay a price for Russia's default.
So if you start to see investors get very nervous about Russia or a default, that can spread to some of these other countries that have nothing to do with this, just out of pure flight to safety, we call it, where people don't understand what's going on in the world, and they go to treasuries or something that they know will be safe. And that can pull money out of developing countries almost overnight.
If vast sums of money flee developing countries that are already on the edge financially, that can drag down currencies and even usher in recession. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up,
higher dealer markups for those vehicles.
Yeah, tell me about it. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 599 today, 1.8%, 33,544 with the happy sad, or I guess it's the sad happy music. NASDAQ up 367, 2.9%, 12,948. The S&P 500 lifted 89 points, 2.1%, 42.62 there. I heard from Lily Jamali and Matt Levin about the high prices of gas and diesel. So looking at some petroleum stocks, ExxonMobil down 5.7% today, Chevron down 5%, ConocoPhillips slipped about 1.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, get this, 2.14%. I mean, yes, I was out yesterday, but still, it's quite the jump. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Regular listeners will know that I am a proud, proud minivan driver. We even did a segment a good long while ago, granted, about how I could drive it more fuel efficiently. Try it though I might, though, gas at $6 a gallon at the station around the corner from me kind of defeats whatever light touch on the gas pedal I could muster. So, and this is true, we were talking this weekend at my house about something more electric, or plug-in hybrid, maybe. Suggestions, of course, welcome, but as you might guess, finding an EV or a hybrid right now? That ain't no easy task. Marketplace's Andy Euler is on it.
As an engineer who studies alternative fuel vehicles, you'd think Cameron Proctor would be one of those guys who's all humble bragging about how many miles per gallon he's getting right now.
No, I can't afford hybrid, but I want a hybrid.
Now, he considered a Toyota SUV hybrid the last time he was in the market for a car in 2016, but the sticker price was too high. He went with a used Chevy Equinox, a compact SUV, and he got the EcoBoost model, which has a bit better fuel efficiency but isn't a hybrid. Gas also wasn't $5 a gallon back then. Proctor says these days,
you know, I look at something like the Highlander hybrid because I have a kid and I have dogs. It's getting 30 mile city. It has 306 horsepower. You know, if you do have that kind of disposable income, part of me says, why not?
That's a calculation many Americans are making right now. Stephanie Brindley is a principal analyst at S&P Global Mobility. She does think we'll eventually see a big shift to electric vehicles, but that won't only be about the price at the pump.
It's not about the fuel price in and of itself. It's going to be because the vehicles are increasingly in price points and segments and size classes that already fit in consumers' lifestyles.
Like Proctor's hypothetical Highlander hybrid. Automakers are investing in and promoting their next-gen alternative fuel vehicles, but they're not producing a whole lot of them yet. Sam Fiorani at Auto Forecast Solutions says it's also more likely that car makers are counting on that demand shift to electric vehicles being a lot more gradual.
If you're looking at shifting from gas-guzzling pickup trucks that sell a lot and make a lot of profit to electric vehicles that require dedicated plants, dedicated suppliers, and don't make a lot of profit at the moment, that's going to be a slow, slow shift.
He says more than the chip supply problem we've all heard about, the lack of EVs for sale right now is due to normal pace of production. And Chris Hardo at Consumer Reports says for those customers who are ready to make the switch and can find the EV that they want, there's not a lot of negotiating happening at the dealership.
You have a kind of set supply of EVs that are going to be built this year, and increasing demand for that limited number of vehicles, and it's translating into higher dealer markups for those vehicles.
And the higher those markups, the further down the road it's going to be before consumers start to see those savings from plugging in rather than filling up. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
About 10 years ago, give or take, I took a quick trip to Las Vegas to do a workplace story.
As we make our way through the maze of cubicles and conference rooms, different departments introduce themselves with different noisemakers. Western Wear rang some cowbells for us. Dinner Bells announced the clothing team. And the travel team, for some reason, happily squeezed rubber ducks. Down the hall in the lunchroom, a woman was singing karaoke. Pretty well, too, actually.
Zappos, the online shoe retailer that was bought by Amazon in 2009 for just shy of $1 billion, had a lot of visitors, like me, in the early 2010s. CEO Tony Hsieh had become famous for and had written a best-selling book about centering happiness at that company.
Over time, we keep expanding the vision, and so now our vision and mission now is it's about delivering happiness to the world.
Tony Hsieh officially left Zappos in August of 2020. He died a couple of 3 months later at the age of 46. There's a new book out about his life and his death. It's called Happy at Any Cost. It's written by Wall Street Journal reporters Kirsten Grind and Catherine Sayer. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Kirsten, here's the thing about Tony Hsieh, of many things that we will talk about. Happiness for him was kind of a product, right?
Oh my gosh, completely. He had started it with infusing Zappos with this kind of wacky culture early in the aughts. And then it just really exploded after 2010 when he published this bestseller, Delivering Happiness. He just became known as this happiness guru.
Catherine, did that catch on? I mean, you know, that book was number one on the New York Times bestseller list for a long time for a business book. Did it work?
Absolutely. I mean, people from all around the world went out to Las Vegas to see for themselves what this happiness culture was all about. And I think he also made employees really happy because that happiness culture, you know, translated into some real action. So he took care of their employees, paid them pretty well. They had a lot of parties in that office, which I think you saw.
Yeah, they did. It was a trip being out there, I'll tell you what. But look, Kirsten, let me ask you this. The Tony Hsieh that everybody saw, including me, was not the Tony Hsieh that his friends and close confidants saw. And that's
definitely
the crux of this book,
not, right?
Yeah.
Sadly, Tony privately struggled quite a bit with severe social anxiety as well as some face blindness issues, with which make it hard to recognize even your loved ones. He abused alcohol. That was pretty well known throughout his life to sort of help with that. But all of this was very private. I mean, the outward Tony was this super generous, charismatic guy, so fun, like always just caring so much about other people. He just unfortunately didn't take care of himself in a way that he should have.
So Catherine, help me make that connection between Tony the private guy and this product that he was selling.
Well, you know, he this drive for happiness. I mean, Tony was a lot of fun, but he was also very driven. And he was looking for happiness in bigger and bigger ways, right? So he started with Zappos. Then he looked outside of Zappos to Las Vegas and wanted to invest $350 million in redeveloping a city. I think he was constantly seeking, but not always reflecting on his own personal happiness.
Did his friends and confidants, I mean, they tried to reflect it back to him, right? You write about that.
Certainly. There were attempts to intervene, but, you know, the pandemic really affected Tony as someone who never really wanted to be alone. I mean, he chose to live in an Airstream trailer park instead of his mansion because he always wanted to be around people. And so the pandemic was really difficult for him.
Say more, actually, about that, either one of you, because we should, you know, point out this book was co-reported. But the last, oh, I don't know, like two, maybe 18 months of his life are, I mean, the whole thing is a tragedy, but the last 18 months are really hard to read.
It's really a heartbreaking story. It was incredibly difficult reporting for that reason, too. He started dabbling in drugs and ketamine, and his friends pushed him into rehab. He left rehab after only 2 weeks, and then the pandemic hit, and he was basically stuck in Park City, Utah, away from all his close friends, and it just pretty much went downhill from there.
Could we talk for a second about, because we kind of danced around it, right? But we have to talk about mental health. And Catherine, I want to talk about mental health, which since the pandemic, I think, has gotten not enough, but certainly more of a share of the public conversation. But mental health with CEOs is still a little bit taboo.
Absolutely. You know, we have to think about the ways in which we hold entrepreneurs on a pedestal today. You know, Silicon Valley tech work is almost like a religion now, and the CEOs are the leaders, and that creates a lot of pressure, and I don't think the culture is there yet. That's one of the key things we hope people will take away from this book and contribute to a conversation about that, like lifting that stigma within that community.
Yeah. It has to be said, Kirsten, that for all that Tony Hsieh tried to make Zappos the fun place and the happy place and the it's not work, it's a family place, that didn't work.
It started to not work, yes. I think for a lot of years it did work, but as Tony's sort of star rose and he became less of like a human and more of a public figure, superstar kind of entrepreneur, that translated back to the workplace and it became sort of more forced is what we heard from a lot of people when he was at the beginning of Zappos in the early aughts or even right after delivering happiness. It was almost so genuine and so innocent, but then it became more like this product, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And it was weird, but it definitely was organic for sure, you know, 10 years
ago. That's right. Yeah. One of the things that was very sad as well is, you know, when in 2020, when Tony had moved and he was kind of looking for his next big thing, you saw that he kind of started comparing himself to these other tech CEOs like Elon Musk, especially, and what they had done. And he started thinking, did I succeed? Like, did I do enough? I shouldn't have maybe gone down this happiness path or put so much prominence on employees. He started kind of questioning his whole thing.
Kirsten Grind and Catherine Sayer, reporters at The Wall Street Journal, also most recently the authors of a book called Happy at Any Cost, The Revolutionary Vision and Fatal Quest of Tony Hsieh. Thanks you two very much for coming on and thanks for this book. Important stuff.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you or somebody you know is in crisis, here's the number 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-8255. final note on the way out today about which I don't, what? I mean, okay, I guess. Word came this morning that AMC, the movie theater chain so much in the news last year for the memification of its stock, up something like 1,600% last June amid the Reddit and Wall Street Bets frenzy. Anyway, AMC has spent $28 million to buy into a gold mine. No, gold mining is not a movie theater chain's core competency, thanks for asking. Capitalizing on publicity, though, does seem to be AMC's. Its shares up 5-ish percent. Today, the mine in question, Hycroft, ticker symbol HYMC. Fair warning, it's kind of a penny stock, up 13 cents today, about 10%. All right, we're going. Here, though, is your moment of economic context. Do with this what you will. The Senate passed a bill today, unanimously, by the way, to make daylight saving time permanent. Still, of course, has to pass the House. Biden has to sign it. There you go. I know there are all kinds of studies talking about how it's a bad economic idea. I personally, though, kind of like the time change. Don't at me. Our digital and on-demand team includes Carrie Barber, Siobhan Brett, Dylan Mietinen, Janet Wynn, Olga Oxman, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.